Hurricane season is around the corner. Are you prepared? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The new season begins within the next couple of weeks, and of course, it's time to start setting up a plan and gathering supplies. And we hear from the new National Hurricane Center director. We talked to him about preparation and the impact of climate change on hurricanes.
Sea level rise. So automatically, the first thing that comes to your mind is, well, you know, storm surge could be higher.
Plus, a new report shows that hundreds of immigrant kids in Miami-Dade schools are being sent to adult GED programs instead of being placed in regular schools. Finally, it's the 50th anniversary of what was the first rock festival on the East Coast, predating Woodstock by a year, the Miami Pop Festival. We'll talk to the photographer who covered that festival and photographed the iconic Jimi Hendrix. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Hurricane season begins June 1st. The season starts as parts of the Florida Keys continue to recover from the devastation caused by Hurricane Irma, and of course Puerto Rico still trying to recover after Hurricane Maria. Now, before the start of each season, they have the annual Governor's Hurricane Conference, and this year it was at Palm Beach County's Convention Center. Now, the conference has a number of sessions scheduled on hurricane preparedness and communication, but they didn't have a single session on the impacts of climate change on the intensification of storms. Now, we spoke with the new director of the National Hurricane Center, Ken Graham, from the conference, where he was a keynote speaker. And I started by asking Mr. Graham, what were the lessons learned from last year's hurricane season?
I really know how it feels, you know, seeing the last 10 years in Katrina and you know, Katrina forecasting, and you look at spending time in New Orleans and the impacts that we had there. You know, I really know how that feels. And, you know, it's one of these things that you have to remember, you know, after a disaster, it's interesting we become more resilient. You really see neighbor helping neighbor. You see family being closer. You know, you become closer as a community. And I think going forward, it's about recovering. And I think from a weather standpoint of it, it's being careful using those storms as the new benchmark. Every one of these storms is so incredibly different. And, you know, if you didn't get impact in one of those storms, but you were close, it doesn't mean it might not happen next time. So it's one of these things that we can't use these storms to compare each other. But, you know, in the end result, we become closer as a community.
Mr. Graham, Florida is historically among the most vulnerable states. Now, last year, Hurricane Irma was a Category 5, and it looked like it was going to be a direct hit on Miami, but we got lucky. Your understanding of the state and also coastal cities' infrastructure and planning, are we ready for another big storm?
You know, it is all about that resiliency. It's a recovering. It's the lessons learned. And, you know, I've seen it many times in other locations, and I've seen it in Florida. You know, you take the lessons learned from the previous season, and you work those plans. And we're sitting here at a conference, the Florida Governor's Conference for the Hurricanes, and everybody's talking about lessons learned and how to get better. We're sharing this information with each other, and I've seen it many times. It's one of these things that you go through this big season, whether it's, you know, whether it's Irma, whether it's Harvey, whether it's Maria, and you rebuild, you become more resilient. And every single time, I've seen us become better and more ready for the next storm. If you look at history, each one of these bad seasons brings new ways of doing business, brings improvements, and brings increased resiliency.
Is there one thing about last year's season, though, like that is a lesson that you really want everyone to remember?
You know, I think you look at, you know, a lot of people have already heard we set a record with the hurricane track forecasting and also intensity. So we're getting a lot better when it comes to the science. But here's what we got to really remember. The better we do, the smaller the cone. So if you think about it, the cone is simply a cone of mathematical analysis of how well we do over the last 5 years. A couple of really good years, smaller cone. If we struggle a little bit, the cone gets bigger. So here's what we always got to remember. It's really critical. Are the impacts can be well outside the cone. In fact, hundreds and hundreds of miles away from that cone, you could get some of the worst conditions in some cases with a tropical system, heavy rain, tornadoes, storm surge. So one of the big things, it's not a cone of impact. You could be hundreds of miles away and still get big impacts from tropical systems.
You know, in a lot of ways, you're uniquely prepared for this position. You started your career as a broadcast meteorologist. Talk about your experience working in the media and how it got you ready for this job.
You know, I think working in the media and everything that I've done in the Weather Service last 24 years, it is so clear to me you know, the degree is in meteorology, I got math and physics, but the bottom line is it's about people. Everything we do with the science has to be relatable and actionable by the people. And it's not always easy to make that translation. And I think for me, it is. I saw it in television weather. There's so many stories that go back to being wall to wall with whether it's a hurricane or a tornado event. And everything you do is trying to communicate what that impact is going to be to a person. And if you can do that, then there's some action, there's some preparedness that takes place, and lives are saved. That's the whole game, and that's what keeps me going. That's what keeps me passionate. It's all about people.
You're the new face of the organization. You oversee the outreach and the preparedness messaging. How are you coordinating with the media to get that message out there for rapid communications, especially when we start getting closer to storms?
You know, I think across the country, we're seeing more of these integrated warning teams where offices are meeting with the media and emergency managers in the same room. I want to keep doing that, too. And I've never seen a time in my career, you know, with so much information out there, I've never seen a time that the need isn't greater than now for us all to be together, the media, emergency management, because all the studies show a consistent message saves lives. And I think it's really reaching out to the media. It's attending the conferences. It's being here today, talking about the real issues. And I think going forward, I mentioned this social science. I mentioned the behavioral science and looking at our products. That's going to take us all to get there. So, you know, we're all going to have to be in the room, the media, emergency management, and really have conversation about what's going well, what are the challenges, and let's go there together. And I think that's one big thing that I really want to do in this new position.
FEMA Administrator Brock Long spoke at the conference this week arguing Floridians shouldn't expect the federal government to be everywhere on the ground the days during and following a hurricane. Does that mean that it's going to be on local governments and the state during recovery effort?
Yeah, I think for us, being a meteorologist at the Hurricane Center, for me, it's all about giving not only the federal, state, and local partners, but also the media. You know, my job is going to give everyone the best forecast that we can. And I think, you know, related to that, I guess before the storm is communicating those impacts. But, you know, one thing that we want to talk about, indirect fatalities associated with tropical systems. So part of it is that readiness. But, you know, the majority of indirect fatalities is cardiac arrest, believe it or not. And we have to continue to send the messaging out after the storm about reminders about, you know, looking at chainsaw, generator safety, electrical line safety, all these safety measures. So for our job, our mission is related to that science and communicating those impacts.
But I want to make sure I'm not reading into this incorrectly. Is what Mr. Long said that the federal government isn't going to be as involved during and after the storm, especially when it comes to cleanup, it comes to recovery? I mean, is it just going to be on the local governments in the state?
Yeah, I can't speak to FEMA, but I mean, he's got his message, and we're going to do everything we can to support him with the science.
You were not there during Hurricane Katrina, but you did go back to New Orleans after the hurricane. You served as the system operations chief at Southern Region Headquarters. You led a team and helped in the recovery efforts and critical repairs. Can you tell me, what were the things that you gathered? What did you learn about working after the storm, you know, those experiences, and, you know, how that's going to help you if in case anything like that hits us here?
You know, one of the things that I saw after Katrina was its communications. It was interesting when your cell phone doesn't work. It was interesting how many people would take their cell phone out every couple minutes and look at it just in case it was working. We're so dependent on this technology. And that's one of the reasons I'm happy to have a ham radio license and, you know, having ways to communicate if you're not able to versus a cell phone, or finding any radio station you can just to get some sort of information. So it is about that. You start losing the things that we depend on. And I tell you, it's amazing that you got to have multiple sources to get that information. Or after the storm, you know, many of those main ways you get information is not there. So you got to have multiple sources to get that information. That was a big lesson after Katrina.
Researchers, including the Union of Concerned Scientists, have argued climate change is exacerbating the strengths of hurricanes. Yet none of the sessions at the conference focus on climate change research as it relates to hurricanes. As the new director, how are you approaching this topic?
You know, I think for me, it's you know, it relates back to some of the conversation I had about the impacts. And a couple things to talk about here. You know, it's hard to take one storm or one season and equate it to climate change. Because if you think about it, we can find other seasons that were worse, other seasons that were similar. So that part of it's difficult. But the one conversation that I know that we do have, and we had a lot of this conversation in Louisiana, was, you know, you got sea level rise. So it, you know, automatically the first thing that comes to your mind is, well, you know, storm surge could be higher. But that's not really what we were communicating. The inward extent of that storm surge is part of the conversation. So if the storm surge used to go, you know, a few miles inland in Louisiana, it would go a lot further. So it's impacts like that. There's a little more subtleties to those impacts. And the other part is the conversation about rain. You know, a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture, and you can get some heavier rain events. So it goes back. It goes back to those impacts and looking at what those impacts are and be able to be ready for those.
Is there a concern about discussing climate change and talking about hurricanes at the same time, though?
I don't think there's any concern. I think it, you know, for me anyway, in my career, it's been about what we're going to see on the ground. And I think the focus, a lot of the focus of this conference is preparedness. It really is about being resilient and being ready for the next one. So, there's plenty of those. There's plenty of conferences where those topics are occurring. But I know for this one, it's really focused on emergency management and the preparedness for that.
One of the things that's going to be discussed at this conference is new predictors and new technologies. How much better have we gotten at tracking storms, predicting storms, and knowing what they're going to do next?
You know, I think we really set a record when it came to the track forecast. And I think we're shaving knots off the intensity forecast as well. So we're really getting better at all that. And you think about it, the NOAA satellite, we're looking into the storm in ways we've never seen before. We can see those eyewall replacements. We can see the wobbles. And a little wobble makes a big difference on the ground. So maybe, you know, having that, we might be able to get ahead of that with some of the impacts. But the other part of it is using these technologies to gather data possibly in the northwest United States. Why is that important? You can have a trough digging that may be weak and doesn't turn a hurricane, or it could be stronger than expected and actually turn the hurricane. All that data gets into the models, and as a result, we're seeing the models get better and better. And as a result, even with a perfect forecast, the storm's still going to come. And dividing that up into the individual impacts, that's where I think you're going to get a lot more science being to start looking at the water, the heavy rain threat. You look back, it's a long time ago, but Hurricane Camille, there were more fatalities inland than there were along the coast from a Cat 5. And that was really resulting in all that rainfall inland. And that's where a lot of the focus has to be. And I think you're going to see a lot more communication, a lot more science being put into that.
There is an exercise provided at this year's conference. It's hashtagged Hurricane Hunt. It shows how social media can be used during an emergency or disaster. Can you tell me a little bit about how that's going to work?
Yeah, you know, I think the social media is such a big factor. You know, I look at my own family and you know, my kids get everything from social media. So what a big factor. We're able to reach more people than we've ever been able to reach before. But, you know, I've been saying this at this conference, you know, there's so much information out there. And, you know, the studies show that a consistent message saves lives. And lots of conflicting messages can cause a paralysis when it comes to decision making. So I've never seen a time in my career where it wasn't more important than now for the media to be together with emergency management, with us, all of us together to talk about, like today, talk about preparedness and talk about the science and the challenges that we have. But during a storm, you know, communicating the impacts together and being able to say, here's the range of possibilities. So, you know, in this direction, these are some possibilities. If the storm does this, these are the possibilities. And that's maybe a better way to really have some sort of focus on those uncertainties, because when it comes to a hurricane, there's always a lot of uncertainties.
One of the things that we learned, one of the difficult things we learned last year is, well, Florida is very narrow. And when it comes to basically leaving the state, leaving an area, it's very limited in where you can go. And so we saw that with Hurricane Irma, a lot of people trying to leave South Florida and then, of course, clogging up the roads. What would you tell, you know, people in different regions when a storm is coming? When should they consider evacuating, or what they should consider about, you know, just hunkering down or going to a shelter? I mean, we're just limited in the ability to get out if we had to.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, Florida, if you think about it, we can get Atlantic side, Gulf side. It could come up you know, similar to Irma, come up from the south through the Keys. Very difficult. And I think for me, I mean, I got to rewrite my own plan too, coming from New Orleans into Florida. I've got to look at my own situation, analyze my own risk, and know my zone. It's one of these things that, you know, becomes a little bit at the risk of giving another cliche here, you know, listen to the local officials. But knowing that zone and you know, understanding that zone and where you're going to go, I mean, it's not as easy in Florida to be able to escape those impacts. So the biggest thing is reducing the highest risk. If you're in a storm surge zone, it's going to be storm surge. You got to get out of that risk. So somehow it's a matter, if you can't get out, it's a matter of mitigating that risk, understanding the risk of where you're at, and trying to lower that risk somewhere.
We always get the forecasts. We're told how many storms are going to come or what to expect, how many could become major hurricanes. There are a lot of people who live in Florida who just moved here, and they haven't been through one, so they don't know. What's the message about how to read forecasts when they start making predictions? How should people be thinking about that information?
You know, I think it's one of these things that, whether it's a busy season or not, none of that's important when it comes to preparedness. You know, you always hear the old slogan, it only takes one, but here's another way to look at it, especially for people that are just moving here. If there's one storm on earth, if it comes to Florida, it's busy for us. So their preparedness has to include getting information, knowing the risk, where they are, what evacuation zone they live in. Are you in a surge risk? Do you have a giant tree next to your house that may be old that could fall on your house? How do you mitigate some of those type of things? So understanding the risk, have a plan. We say it so much, it's at the risk of people not really thinking about it as much because we say it so often. But having that plan is everything. It's reducing the stress of the hurricane by knowing where you're going to go, knowing what your vulnerabilities are, and having, you know, stuff, having medicine, having food, having water for the first 72 hours. Because in the big storms, as I've seen a lot in my career, you're on your own for a little while. And that's a big message. Be ready, be prepared. And that way, you know, you'll be ready to do what you have to do in the next storm.
That was Ken Graham, the new director for the National Hurricane Center. He was the keynote speaker at the annual Governor's Hurricane Conference, which is still going on today. Hurricane season starts June 1st. And remember, this is the time to start preparing. Now, if you were here for Irma, then you remember the long lines at the gas station. You remember stores running out of basic necessities. So start getting ready now. Get those things now. Now, we're going to post more online at WLRN.org. We'll go back to that checklist that you should know so, so well. On a separate note, we've got a segment next week we want to get your input on. Robocalls, you know, those automated calls you get to your cell with a machine on the other end. Well, they're happening in the billions across the United States. And we're going to talk with a Florida lawmaker on Tuesday about what's being done to slow them down here. And we want to hear from you. What's your robocall story? Have you or a family member been scammed by a robocaller? Text the word sundial to 63735. Again, that's sundial to 63735. Or send us an email, sundial@wlrnnews.org. All right, still to come, in Miami-Dade, schools pushing immigrant kids into GED programs so they don't have to worry about teaching them English. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Hello and welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Miami-Dade is the country's fourth largest school district, and it serves roughly 350,000 students. 67,000 of those students are English language learners. Well, the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald just came out with a new report about how some of those students are being pushed into a GED program called Success Management Academies. A big part of it has to do with the fact that these kids, well, they can't really speak English, and that could impact test results, which in turn, of course, impacts school funding and teacher pay. Now, we should note, the Miami-Dade County Public School District is the broadcast license holder of WLRN, but has no editorial control. We have reached out to them for comment, and we're still waiting for a response. Joining us now is Lena Jackson, a documentary filmmaker and contributor with the Miami Herald for the story. She spent many years investigating the educational experiences of recently arrived immigrant students in the area. Lena, it is great to have you here. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You arrived here a couple of years ago, actually, right?
Yep, in February of 2016.
Okay, so what piqued your curiosity to look at the experiences of immigrant kids in the Miami-Dade area?
Well, I knew I was moving to Miami, and I had done a lot of my journalism and filmmaking career had been around education. And so I'd actually gotten a fellowship to look at educational experiences of recently arrived immigrant students. And so I came to Miami and just started reaching out to people, digging around a little bit. It was around that time that the Southern Poverty Law Center filed a legal complaint against Collier County Schools for doing similar but not exactly the same things that Miami-Dade County seems to be doing, which is steering students away as soon as they sort of get to a school door, saying, you know, either you don't speak enough English or you're too old to enroll in high school, so you need to go to an alternative program. Palm Beach County had also done, there was a lawsuit against Palm Beach County Schools in 2012 for doing exactly the same thing. So I was just interested in sort of finding out, like, what's going on here? And so I got in touch with the district, and they introduced me to several teachers and students at the Miami-Jackson GED program. And so I embedded there for several months, interviewing students, interviewing administrators, interviewing teachers. I also was able to embed in the Miami Springs GED program. The schools are very different. You know, Jackson is sort of in the heart of Miami. It serves an overwhelmingly large Central American population, a lot of Dominican students, whereas Miami Springs is much more Cuban. And so I wanted to sort of see the differences between the two.
So let's understand what's happening. So we've got immigrant kids coming in. Most of these kids don't speak English or very little English?
Very little English. I never spoke English with any of the students.
Okay. And so they arrive, and what's happening? I mean, when you're anybody, any kid comes in, you have to go to school, so you have to apply to whatever school you're going to. What's the school district doing to these kids the moment they arrive?
So there are two things that happen. One is that students who arrive, maybe when they're 13 or 14, or maybe even younger, go to a regular high school, quote-unquote regular or normal high school. That's what everyone sort of refers to them as. And then when they turn 16, entering 10th or 11th grade, knowing that this huge standardized test in English, the FSA, which is an exit exam requirement here in the state of Florida, is coming, administrators seem to be giving students an option. Hey, you know, this is a program that's in Spanish. You can sort of get a GED quickly. You may not be able to graduate from high school with a diploma because of the standardized test and because of all the requirements.
They're pulling these kids aside and saying, you may not graduate high school.
You may not graduate high school because you're not going to be able to pass this test.
Are they trying to push them into this program? Because you said they're giving them options.
It's unclear what the intentions are of the school district. You know, in some ways, yeah, it's unclear. The other situation that's going on is basically students who are arriving when they're 16 and going to their local school and basically being told, no, you don't know the language. You're 16. You're never going to be able to pass this test. You got to go to the GED program right away.
They arrive and immediately. What's the process? How does the school district decide? They're talking to this kid right away, figuring, nope, you don't speak any English. Not even going to try to get you into high school.
Not even going to try. A lot of the times it's just the registrar at the school. And we found in our article in Homestead, students who were being, there were five students who were reported to, from an organization called We Count. There were five students who came to the organization saying, we just got denied enrollment. What can we do? The organizer from We Count went to the schools and said, hey, we want to enroll our students into this school. And the regular high school in Homestead said, no, that's not a possibility.
And by the way, what role do the parents play in all this? Are they talking to the parents at all?
Seemingly not. Most of the students I talked to said there was never a conversation with their parents. If that is students who were in a regular school and moved to a GED program. The students who are new, literally fresh off the boat or fresh off the train or fresh off the airplane, a lot of times they are going with family members, but you've got to remember those family members don't necessarily speak English. They have absolute trust and faith in this public institution. And if the school district is telling them this is the best alternative for you, they're going to believe them. They don't know that it's their constitutional right to go to the regular school. And that is exactly it. There was a 1982 Supreme Court case, Plyer versus Doe, that very clearly states it is unconstitutional to deny students, any student, based on their immigration status, their race, whatever, to deny them entrance into a K-12 education. And in Florida, in the U.S., there's a federal mandate that says you have to provide education to kids up till the age of 21. In Florida, there's not really a maximum age. And according to the district, it's done on a student-by-student basis.
So I want to know, by the way, why the schools are doing this. Why the schools are deciding to just give these kids that option or push them into these programs if that's what they're doing. I mean, what's the purpose? Why not put them in a classroom? What's it going to hurt them if they put the kid in the classroom?
So in Florida, the state, everything is sort of wrapped around the test, the FSA, and also the school grade. If a school receives an A, they're going to get a lot more funding. And funding, meaning, is based on teacher evaluations, the way students perform on these tests. So if a school is continuously performing poorly, C grade, D grade, F grades, then there is an incentive for the administration to say, you know what, these students are going to negatively affect our testing. They might negatively affect our school grade. So maybe we should give them an alternative.
Don't put them in the classroom then. Okay. Let's listen to a portion of an interview you did with Joey Bautista, the former Miami Jackson Adult Education Center director, talking about the GED program and the immigrant experience.
No one leave their country and take either swim or take a boat or cross a walk for miles and days, cross to under extreme circumstances because they want a better education. That could get it home. They all made that journey because they were looking for work. They came here for financial hope. Now they've gone through the journey, through the hardship of getting here. Now what do we do, okay? And this is where this program is like a gold mine, because what we do is we're gonna get you a trade.
Is his description of the trade program accurate? Do you agree with that?
I never heard anything about a trade program at any of the GED programs. You know, a lot of people have read what Joey Bautista said and are just in total shock. I want to note that he was fired from the school district last school year for using district funds to pay his own personal housekeeper and is currently awaiting trial. But, you know, every student that I talk to came here for a better life. And part of that better life is getting an education. And getting an education in an American school where you can socialize with American peers, where you can assimilate into American culture. In order to have a successful career, in order to gain financial success, you have to get a good education. And a lot of these students simply did not feel that the GED program was providing them with that.
All right, this GED program is called Success Management Academies. Help us understand, what is this? Is it a typical GED program? Again, this is mostly for kids who do not speak English or very little English. But what's the program? How's this set up?
So I think it was originally set up. It was originally set up in 2015. I think it was probably in response to the surge of unaccompanied minors coming to the U.S. in the 2014-2015 time, and it's specifically for students who are between the ages of 16 and 18, don't speak English or have very limited English. It's taught during the school day. So it depends on the school. Like at Miami Springs, it was from 7 to 2. At Miami Jackson, it was from 9 to 5. So they basically have, you know, a full school day, I think around 4 hours of GED prep. So they're prepping for the, you know, social studies exam, the language arts exam, the math exam, the science exam. And then they're given about 2 hours of ESOL. And they wear school uniforms. They go to, you know, the school is within often the school's campus. In Miami Springs, the program is actually in the school. And so, you know, I think the district did that to sort of make the students feel like they were still part of the regular school, even though they are in separate areas. And so, you know, it's basically that, you know, a 9 to 5 sort of school day, but GED test prep.
Again, I'm talking with Lena Jackson, documentary filmmaker and contributor to a Miami Herald story that came out recently, looking at how the Miami-Dade school system is moving a number of immigrant kids, hundreds, over 1,000 immigrant kids, into this GED program called Success Management Academies, basically because these kids don't speak English or very little English, and so it's going to hurt testing results. And of course, those test results go towards the grades for the schools, and that of course goes to funding for those schools and teacher pay. Just a note again, we have reached out to the school district. We're still waiting for a response on this story. Is the program, do we know anything about this program? Is it successful? Does it, I mean, you know, are kids getting their GEDs, and then what happens to them?
So the school district doesn't really have comprehensive data on the success rate, both retention and graduation rates. And that's in part because the GED testing companies don't release those scores. And so the school district has to literally follow up individually with each student. In our report, we reported that fewer than a third of the students are graduating from these GED programs. And again, that number, we don't know how many students they polled or have actually come to them. I imagine it's a lot less. But if you just look at GED pass rates at the state level, it's about 16% compared to high school graduation rates, which are about over 80%. So those numbers alone, even if we take away Miami-Dade, show students are much more successful at a regular high school level. They're much more likely to graduate with a diploma from a regular high school than they are from a GED program.
And have you had the chance to talk to any of these kids after they're out of the program, or whether they decide to leave the program because it's not working for me, and then what? I want to know what's happening to them.
Yeah, so I have talked to a few of the students, and fortunately, a lot of students have graduated. But what a lot of students are the situation that a lot of students are in right now is you graduate from this program, and they want to enroll in Miami-Dade College. But in order to enroll in Miami-Dade College and in the regular college curriculum, you have to know English. These students are not graduating these GED programs with any comprehension in English. So they have to take remedial English classes at Miami-Dade College for a year, 2 years, 3 years. And one thing that we reported was that a lot of students who are doing that end up, they might be getting some sort of government grant funding, Pell Grants, they end up using all of their Pell Grant money just on remedial English. So before they even get to a college curriculum, they've already used up all of their scholarship funding and may not be able to continue on to a regular college curriculum.
Is the school district doing anything illegal here? In again, trying to push these kids into this program, is there anything, are they doing anything wrong?
If the school district is not having one-on-one meetings with every parent and student, giving them all of their options, then yes, they're not only doing something illegal, they are doing something that is against the U.S. Constitution.
I want to know, is there a school district in the country that is doing it the right way?
Right. So we had a follow-up story this morning because we really wanted to address some of the possible solutions, districts that are looking at immigrant education in a more sort of progressive way. So we found in both New York City, D.C., Oakland, there are what are either called immigrant high schools or newcomer academies. And basically those are regular high schools that either have a sort of a very specific ESOL program where these recently arrived immigrants are taking both a mix of ESOL classes and then also sort of being mainstreamed into the regular high school, or high schools that are just for immigrants.
Why can't students just stay in school longer? I mean, there's no law in Florida that says a kid has to get out of school by 18, high school by 18. So why not keep them in school longer?
Costs money. You know, it costs about almost $3,000 to educate a student. And if that student is continuously not passing the FSA test, then A, that's affecting the school grade, and B, that's costing the school district a lot more money. But this is a county that is filled with immigrants. The superintendent himself is an immigrant, and he prides himself on immigrant education. So you would think that they would be, you know, spending all their resources on making sure that all these kids were coming.
And again, we reached out to them. We're still waiting for a comment. Have they commented on the stories?
You know, we reached out to them with a bunch of questions, and they responded. And we reported this in our piece, but I think they did say that they plan on sort of reviewing the programs. You know, one of them said that, you know, the programs were started with the purest intentions, but, you know, they might need to review some of their practices, you know, and train some of the registrars or people who are dealing with these students when they come to their school doors, that you just can't say no. You cannot say no. You cannot turn these students away.
Again, we've been talking with Lena Jackson, documentary filmmaker and contributor to a Miami Herald piece, two of them, actually. And you can find the links on our Facebook page. Again, talking about Miami-Dade County Public School District, you know, pushing some kids into a GED program because they barely speak any English. And, of course, they're telling them, you're not going to graduate if you don't know English. That could hurt test scores. That could, of course, hurt school funding. There's so much to the story. Lena, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
And I do have to mention again, Miami-Dade County Public School District is the broadcast license holder of WLRN, but they have no editorial control. We have reached out to them. We'll keep trying to get a comment on this story. Still to come, a look back on a time when rockers like Jimi Hendrix came to Miami for a festival. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Hello and welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Stand next to you. You may recognize that voice and guitar riff, the legendary rock star Jimi Hendrix. 50 years ago this month, Hendrix played on a stage made of a flatbed truck in Gulfstream Park. That performance was part of the Miami Pop Festival and a new exhibit from History Museum Miami showcasing the photography from that unique two-day event. Ken Davidoff was a young man with a camera eager to capture all the action. His photos line the exhibit and have been used in documentaries and for album art. And he will be speaking tomorrow at the exhibit's grand opening along with Hendrix's brother, Leon. And he joins me now in studio, not Leon, but Ken. Ken, welcome to the program, Ed.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
It's such a pleasure. You know what? Take us back. It was May 1968. Tomorrow's the 50th anniversary.
Exactly.
First of all, in May, you're sitting in your room listening to Jimi Hendrix. All of a sudden, you hear an ad for Miami Pop Festival on the radio. What's your first reaction?
I gotta go. I gotta see Jimmy. I have to photograph him. I want to hear him in person.
You wanted to photograph this?
Yeah.
Now, at that point in your life, you were already deep into photography. I mean,
not deep. I was only 19 years old, and I started working for my dad's Palm Beach studio when I was 16.
Tell me what festivals were like back in the 60s. I mean, is it anything like what we see today with Coachella and Bonnaroo and things like that?
No, it's a little different.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, Woodstock was the ultimate, and you just have these visions of a sea of people. The Miami Pop Festival had about 25,000 people, and, you know, Gulfstream Park isn't exactly Woodstock, but the promoter, Michael Lang, who also promoted Woodstock, said that the Miami Pop Festival was where the seeds of Woodstock were sown.
Because this is the first real rock
festival. It was a precursor.
It was a year before Woodstock.
A little over a year.
Now, you interviewed the chief organizers behind that pop festival for your 2015 book, Michael Lang and Rick O'Berry.
Right.
Tell me about them.
Well, they're both really great guys as far as that goes. I mean, what happened was Michael lived in Coconut Grove. He opened up the very first head shop in South Florida. And he was friends with Rick O'Berry. Rick O'Berry was the trainer for all five of the dolphins that were on the Flipper TV show. It was crazy.
He was a dolphin capturer, but then he got out of that.
Right. What happened was in 1970, a dolphin died in his arms, and he took that as a sign. And it was actually on Earth Day. So very, you know, very profound. And he said, you know, I'm going to protect the dolphins. And he started the Dolphin Project. And there's a movie called The Cove. I'm sure a lot of people have seen that. That's Rick O'Berry.
Now, when they were putting this together, I mean, was it something well thought out and planned out? Or how did the Miami Pop Festival happen?
Well, according to Michael and Rick, at first they thought they were going to go to the Seminole Reservation. but the timing wasn't right. So they had to hustle around, and they found Gulfstream Park, and they got very creative for the stages. They just used two flatbed trucks, and they decided that there was going to be daytime performance and evening performance. So the daytime Jimmy performance, what happened was we were watching Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention are setting up, and all of a sudden I hear a helicopter's coming in, and I'm like, oh, that's got to be Jimmy, right? So I ran over, and I started taking pictures of Jimmy's arrival. I have pictures with the helicopter in the background, and we put all these pictures into a book that was published not too long ago. It's called The Miami Pop Festival, A Photographic Experience. And
you captured, yeah, there was a photo you had of Jimmy. He's out of the helicopter walking over. There's somebody standing next to him.
Yes, somebody named Linda McCartney.
Linda McCartney.
Linda was there
because the woman who would become Paul McCartney's wife.
Exactly, and she had to photograph Jimmy for the third album. That was her assignment.
Now, you're photographing Zappa, but you hear the helicopter coming, and
I race to the back.
You got
to
run over
where the helicopter is, and then this crazy thing happens. This guy walks up to me, and he hands me all of my film. Now, that just totally freaked me out. What happened was, my camera bag was just that, a camera bag. It doesn't have compartments like you see now with all the Velcro and everything like that. So obviously when I was running around back there, all this film fell out of the camera bag, and some guy, unbelievable, handed it all back to me. And there's even a picture in the book where you can see the film at Jimmy's feet.
He's about
crazy
to step on it.
Yeah.
And that's your film.
That's my film,
as
man.
You're taking the picture, of course. Let's go back to the festival again and listen to a little bit of Hendrix. This is from a recording of the 1968 Miami Pop Festival released in 2013, the song Red House. And you're going to hear Hendrix's voice at the beginning.
I'll try to do a slow blues for you now. That's all right.
All right, tell me about, because look, we know of Hendrix, it's legend now, but
exactly.
You're there. Tell me what you're seeing and what you're feeling. Tell me about his energy.
Ugh, I was so excited to do all these photographs, and at night I had to use a flash. I was fairly new into photography. I didn't know anything about available light photography, so I had this giant flash attached to my camera. It's powered by a 510-volt battery, so you can imagine the power and the light that it has. And I take a full-length shot, looks beautiful, lights up the whole stage, and then I move in close for the second shot. Now, I didn't know this, but the guy who was operating the lights at the time was flashing them back and forth on Jimmy's face, and that really upset him. I took my second picture, and Jimmy said, "No more flashing." And I'm like, does he mean me? Do I have to stop taking pictures? I only have two pictures from the evening performance, but I stopped. There was nothing I could do.
You only got two pictures.
Two pictures from the evening performance.
From the evening
now,
performance.
The daytime performance, that was a different story. I shot, you know, until I was...
What did it feel like, by the way, when Jimmy... Did he look at you, by the way, when he said that? No more pictures.
No, I don't... He didn't actually look at me, but I don't know. My ego took over, and I thought he was talking to me. I don't know.
I'm talking with Ken Davidoff. He's a photographer who captured many of the magical moments of the Miami Pop Festival, which happened 50 years ago this month. Many of his photographs from that event are on exhibit at the History Museum Miami, which starts tomorrow. During the opening tomorrow, Hendrix's brother is going to be performing, and of course Ken's going to be there,
and Leon's going to be performing with Lee Tiger and the Tiger Band, who actually played 50 years ago.
And he brought in, by the way, some of the photographs. They're in a collection in a book, and we're going to post those up on Facebook here in a little bit, so you can take a look at them. Beautiful black and white and color photography. Again, it's the Miami Pop Festival, A Photographic Experience. You have this interesting story of trying to. Let me go back. Before Hendrix, you were getting some of the other performers. You had Zappa Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. John Lee Hooker also.
Yeah, he was pretty much the only acoustic act. And because of that, on the second day, he actually got to perform. He was the only one that wasn't going to get electrocuted.
Why? What happened the second
day? It was raining the second day, and Michael Lang did not take out insurance. You'd think he would have learned for Woodstock to take out insurance for rain, but he didn't do that either.
Well, but this was yeah, he didn't learn for Woodstock because this was the year before.
Right, so. This was a big lesson, and sometimes you have to learn from.
What happened, though, that second day when you had that downpour? How many people stayed?
Not too many people stayed. It was really bad. And the story goes that as Jimmy was leaving in his limousine, he wrote the song Rainy Day, Dream Away. So that's really cool that Miami is attached to that.
You know, you've gone on to photograph a number of other concerts and festivals in Florida. The 1969 Palm Beach Pop Festival.
Right, with some guy named Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones.
How was South Florida attracting these big names at the time? Because, again, South Florida looked very different.
Exactly.
50 years ago.
Oh, and the Palm Beach Pop Festival, that was crazy. Everybody was opposed to it because everybody had already seen what happened at Woodstock, and they didn't want any hippies coming into Palm Beach County. So, I mean, they did stuff like in Palm Beach, they actually drew the bridges up so nobody could cross over into Palm Beach to get onto the island.
Wow.
And they were so opposed to it that the promoter had to get somebody that was religious enough to sway the Palm Beach County Commission. And they got this guy named Arthur Blessed, who was a minister to the hippies out in L.A., and he came. You've probably heard of Arthur Blessed, too. He is in a movie called The Cross, where he had a cross that he carried all around the world.
You know, I wonder, look, people know Woodstock. It is in history forever.
Yeah, exactly.
But why do you think the Miami Pop Festival isn't discussed in history the same way?
You know, that's always been a mystery to me. I try to get the history out as much as I can. But I'm only one person, and if you don't have...
Because, I mean, Hendrix is there. You had Zappa there. You had some big names there.
Exactly.
Why is the Miami Pop... So where do you
it's
think...
It's so obscure that it's just... it's some sort of enigma, you know? It really is. I mean, they should... This is the very first rock festival on the East Coast of the United States. Doesn't get any bigger than that.
You know, aside from the concerts and a lot of festivals that you've covered, you also photographed, I thought this is interesting, the Republican and Democratic National Conventions of 1972.
In Miami.
And you've covered presidents, numerous presidents. And I wanted to know from you, what's unique about photographing conventions like that compared to concerts?
Well, I really love the photojournalism aspect of it, you know, actually... capturing a moment, especially if it's historical. I mean, just 1972 Democratic and Republican conventions, there was a lot of history there, and there were a lot of big, not only celebrities, but, you know, there were the biggest political people of their time, obviously, for the convention. So people like Shirley Chisholm was there, for instance. I photographed... I'm drawing a blank. Too much. I mean, it's been a lot.
A lot of people were down here. It was another big deal.
I mean, Jane Fonda was leading a rally against the war. I got tear gassed by 5 different times because I had a ponytail about down to the middle of my back, and I looked like the other hippies that were protesting the war.
Finally, you think about those moments of the Miami Pop Festival. Is there any one regret?
Yeah, I wish I could have taken more pictures at night.
that one night you get a couple, and Hendrix says, no more flash photography. This has been a lot of fun. Again, talking with Ken Davidoff, again, a photographer who captured so many of the magical moments of the Miami Pop Festival. This is the 50th anniversary of that festival. And a lot of those photographs, by the way, that he's going to have on exhibit at the History Museum Miami. That starts tomorrow, the opening tomorrow. You're going to be there to open it up.
Oh, yeah, 6 to 9, everybody. We want everybody to come out and dress like a hippie.
And
we're going to have a great time. Leon Hendrix is going to play with a band that actually played at the original festival, Tiger Tiger Band with Lee Tiger. And we're going to have a great time.
Ken, it's been a lot of fun, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Lewis.
And that's the program. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great Friday, a wonderful weekend. Talk to you next week.